Well, I am sure we have all heard the joke where the preacher is asked, well, what are you preaching on? And the preacher says, sin. And someone says, well, are you for it or against it? Well, we're going to talk about sin tonight. Well, of course, in one way or another, we're always talking about the problem of sin because that's ultimately what our problem is in any kind of aspect of a relationship with God and what we need to improve. And no matter how encouraging any sermon might be, there is always the presumption that we can do better. Even Paul, when he writes to the Thessalonians, tells them to excel still more in the good that they were doing. We want to be looking in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, a passage here that helps us to learn a little bit about what our attitudes towards sin ought to be. And of course, we're picking up in the middle of an argument that Paul has begun all the way back in the 8th chapter, and we'll see a little bit of how this fits in. But let's just notice the first 13 verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and see what it may teach us about our attitude that we ought to have about sin. Paul says, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were immersed into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happen as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. And then you'll notice that the very next verse, Paul says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. And he goes on to discuss that a little bit more. Well, what this makes us realize is that these 13 verses of the beginning of chapter 10 are part of an integral argument that Paul is making about idolatry. And that argument really began back in chapter 8. And it appears that what was going on in Corinth is that some of the Corinthian Christians were actually going to pagan temples. Maybe they were actual bona fide temples devoted to some pagan deity. Often, when people wanted to throw a birthday party or have some other kind of social occasion, that was the closest thing there was to what we would think of as a banquet hall or a actual restaurant. And so people would hold a lot of festivities there. And so it may not have been that they thought, oh, I want to go worship Zeus or Apollo, as much as it was, oh, my neighbor's asked me to his kid's birthday party, I want to go. Or the Romans built shrines in their cemeteries and had designated days upon which you would come and eat a meal with your departed loved one. And this under the oversight, again, of some patron deity of your family. And so there are a lot of ways of getting involved in idolatry that was so woven into the fabric of everyday life. And you could see a lot of these Corinthian Christians wanting to fit in and to get along with their neighbors. And you could see them trying to rationalize this as actually a way of, you know, reaching out to people that are their neighbors. And, you know, how are we going to reach people if we're just such oddballs and so different from everyone? And in fact, you can see some of their reasoning. In chapter 8, it appears that Paul is quoting and alluding to some of the things that they were saying. And, Paul actually says, well, yeah, we know there is no God but one. And you can see someone at Corinth actually using that as an argument. Well, Paul, you're the one actually making it sound like these idols are real. We know they're not real. So why can't we go to the idol temple and participate in the festivities and all that? Because it doesn't mean anything. And Paul acknowledges, yes, they're not real, but that doesn't mean there isn't any reality to idolatry. I mean, with that kind of reasoning, you could get rid of just about every sin there was. You know, what is idolatry then? It clearly is a sin, and it's talked about in the Bible, but you know, their kind of reasoning would remove it from being any real kind of consideration at all. And the practice of going to the idol temple, notice in verse 10 of chapter 8, if someone sees you who have knowledge dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he's weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? And so that is the one particular specific thing that Paul mentions that makes it pretty clear that's what they were doing. Now, how does this argument fit in here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10? And what does it tell us about the problem at hand? Well, you may recognize a series of examples that Paul gives from verse 6 to verse 11. And it's kind of framed with a similar expression that is used in verse 6. He says, these things happen as examples for us. And then he just generally says that we should not crave or lust after the things that they lusted after. And then we get some very specific examples of the kind of things he's talking about. He mentions four Old Testament events that illustrate particular sins among the people. And then he concludes again in verse 11, these things happened to them as an example and they were written down for us. Now sometimes I think some Christians read those two passages and say, well, example, that's really just like an Aesop's fable is an example. But it doesn't really have any real strength or binding power to it. And that's clearly not how Paul intends it here. Paul is able to say to them, don't be idolaters like they were, because the Bible says you can't do that. And here's example after example after example of things that are displeasing to the Lord, and you know that because that's what the Bible tells you. It's that kind of example that we're talking about. Not just good advice, not just, oh, look at this and think about it. No, you've got to change the way that you're living because of what the Bible teaches. And he's holding up the generation of the Israelites in the wilderness as a poster example of this kind of behavior we need to avoid. Well, the first example that is mentioned is in verse 7. Don't be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Now, this is the only example he cites that quotes Scripture to it, and I think that's significant. It's also the first one that he mentions. And I think what we have here are not four equally parallel examples from the Old Testament, but he begins with what is the specific problem he's been talking about. And the reference, of course, comes from Exodus chapter 32, which is the sin with the golden calf at which Moses breaks the Ten Commandments, because they've already broken all of them anyway. And what were they doing with this golden calf? Well, they sat down in the presence of this idol and engage in this meal eaten under the oversight of this idol, and also practice sexual immorality in connection with that. And so here's a prime example of the very thing that he's talking about. You cannot do that. Did God say in Exodus chapter 32, well, that golden calf's not a real idol? We all know that's just a chunk of metal. No, he said, you're going to die. Or I'm going to punish the nation. You know, God was on the verge of exterminating them, actually, if it had not been for the intercession of Moses. You just cannot do this. And so that's the first example that he gives. It is sitting down in the presence of an idol and eating this food. And the second example he gives picks up on the playing from verse 7, this sexual immorality they get involved in. And he cites another example from the Old Testament, this time from Numbers chapter 25, where 23,000 are smitten in one day, he says here. Numbers 25 says it was 24,000 altogether. But this is the situation that happens at Baal Peor. And once again, they are worshiping this idol, Baal, and eating in its presence and engaging in sexual immorality, as part of this fertility religion thing does so often. And so you can see mentioning the Exodus story and how the passage ended with how they rose up to play, that reminds him to speak of the sexual immorality specifically. And again, that's what the Corinthians were doing. They were also involved in that. And then thirdly, he says, let's not try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. And now we go back to Numbers chapter 21. He's not giving these in chronological order, but he is giving them an order of certain problems that he's dealing with. And he's going to pick up on this testing of the Lord a little bit later in this chapter. You think you're strong enough to take on God? And you want to eat at the table of demons and also eat at the Lord's table? You're not going to be able to do that. Do not test God. And because the people tested God, God sent those fiery serpents, which in the ancient world was typically cobras, to afflict the people. And they died unless they looked to the remedy that God provided for them. And it seems as if there may be a little bit of poetic justice in this, because their grumbling, you'll remember, was, we want to go back to Egypt. Why can't we go back to Egypt? And they've been whining about this ever since they left Egypt. And one of the prominent symbols of Egypt is the cobra. And it's almost as if God's saying, you want Egypt? I'll give you Egypt. How about being bitten by cobras? How do you like that? In fact, their grumbling and testing of the Lord on this occasion was so bad, they said, oh, the food that we had in Egypt, how wonderful it was. And now we've got nothing but this loathsome manna. And now you see the attitude of the people, which is to reject the food that God has provided them and long for the food of Egypt instead. Well, that tests the Lord, obviously. It is a rejection. It is a slap in the face of the Lord. And so likewise, if you're going to pursue this worshiping of idols and this eating in the idol temple and so on, you're testing God and you're rejecting God. Don't do that. And then finally, he brings up the classic case of grumbling, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, it's a little bit more difficult to know exactly which story Paul may have in mind, but the classic grumbling story in which the people were punished by God is in Numbers chapter 16. And this is, of course, the rebellion of Korah. And Korah and the people with him, they were Levites. Now, they weren't of the family of Aaron, so they couldn't be priests. But of all of the non-priestly families in the tribe of Levi, you know, some of them were tasked with the job of setting up the framework of the tabernacle, and some of them were given the responsibility of all the fabric of the tabernacle tent. And some of them were given the privilege of packing up and transporting the holy objects in the tabernacle. Well, that was Korah and his bunch. But that wasn't good enough for them. They wanted to be priests. Why can't we do that too? And their complaint really was directed against Moses. Who do you think you are? Who made you ruler and judge over us? Who made you to be the one to intercede for us with God? We can do that just as well as you can. And so why does Paul bring this up as an example? Well, I think if you think about the relationship Paul had with the Corinthians, you know, he's somewhat like Moses to the children of Israel. He represents God's spokesperson. He's trying to tell them what God wants them to do, and they don't want to hear it. And so they've got a lot of grumbling that they've turned against Paul as part of this process. It's not as important as this first example, which is you just can't go to this idol temple. But part of that, one of the sub-problems involved in that, was their rejection of Paul as an apostle. And so Paul mentions this example of how they grumbled against Moses that spoke for God and as a consequence brought a judgment upon themselves. So the whole argument is, you know, it isn't just like Paul's picking random things from the Old Testament saying, oh, here's a bad thing you ought not to do. Oh, here's another bad thing I can think of and find a few Old Testament passages to support that. He's making a particular argument about a particular sin that the Corinthians are caught up in. And he's saying, you just can't do that. Now, dealing with that specific problem, what do we learn about that particular attitude that one ought to have about sin, or attitudes that we ought to avoid about sin? And, of course, the attitude that we have about sin would be applicable to whatever specific sin it may be. In this case, it's idolatry, but it really doesn't matter what the specific sin is. Well, what attitudes might we run into in dealing with the problem of sin? Well, a couple I'll just mention briefly. One is, we might be conceited. You know, we might be in denial. Can you imagine that there are some sins you will never, ever commit? I will never, ever do that. Well, that may very well be the first step to doing it. And that's Paul's point here in chapter 10, verse 12. Let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. This very attitude, oh, I just can't do that. I'll never do that. Now, I'm not suggesting we're all on the verge of going and doing that. But if you take the attitude, oh, I never have to worry about that. I never have to study about anything that's going to help me guard against that. I never have to give any real attention to it. Then those are the very kinds of neglect that will cause us to get into a condition where we may very well find ourselves falling prey to that temptation. And so let's not be conceited and dismiss, just think in our mind, oh, there's just no way. There's certain things I could never do. And the opposite side of that is just to give up and throw your hands up and give in. Just to concede. Well, we all sin. I can't go a day without sinning. Just can't do it. And I just despair that we can ever live a life before God. And that's Paul's point in verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. There is no sin that you can say, God, I could not help it. There was no other way. In order to do the right thing, I had to do the wrong thing. Have you ever heard people try to justify that as if, you know, because something good came out of something wrong, that made it okay? Or they didn't see any other way to accomplish this good end but to commit some sin. Well, if something is truly good and right and God wants us to do it, there's some way to do it without sinning. May not be pleasant, may not be what we want, but there is a way to do that. There is always a way of escape. With the temptation, God will provide a way of escape also, so you'll be able to endure it. We can deal with the temptation. He doesn't promise God's going to take temptation away from us, but that we will be able to endure it. And so if we don't endure the temptation, if we succumb to the temptation, let's put the blame where it belongs, which is on myself, my own foolish choices. And so the fact that we may be weak, the fact that, you know, we know realistically we may be struggling even with a particular sin, that doesn't change the fact that it's our fault and it's our choice and there is a way out. And there always is a way out. Now, once again, I would hesitate to say that means there's always an instantaneous way out. In other words, if you have gone day after day after day, month after month, and year after year of hardening your heart and rejecting God and so on, you may have so weakened yourself, it is a foregone conclusion that when a certain temptation presents itself to you, you're not able to deal with it. I mean, the Bible warns us about getting to the point where we are so hardened in a heart and seared in our conscience, and that doesn't necessarily have to mean completely hardened in every regard. It may just be in regard to one thing. But what has happened is we have bypassed the way of escape that was offered to us, a way of escape that involved, you know, prayer and Bible study and encouragement and making right choices and so on. And sometimes when we make the wrong choices, there are certain doors that are shut to us. And it's not as if life just has an infinite variety of opportunities and possibilities because there are consequences to some of the choices that we make. But the temptations we face are common to mankind, and if we are determined to find the way of escape, we will be able to find that God brings to us. Then ultimately, it's the third one I really want to talk about, and that is a kind of spiritual complacency that we may develop, that we perhaps see in the attitude of this generation of the Israelites in the wilderness, and apparently from Paul's application of this to them, a problem they're at least on the verge of falling into. And this spiritual complacency has kind of two parts to it, it seems to me. On the one hand, we kind of overestimate our own strength. And so it's similar to the first point, although perhaps not as arrogant and presumptuous as the first one is. But sometimes just looking at ourselves as being stronger perhaps than we really are. And therefore we're not as worried as we ought to be. I mean, if you're a general in charge of some fortified position, and you've really got a lot of troops and weaponry and so on, and you look at how all of that's deployed, and you've just got a great setup, not too worried about what the enemy might throw at you. But if you're not nearly as well defended as you think you are, you have better grounds to worry than you realize. And so we need to err on the side of caution in terms of what our own self-assessment and expectations are, how we're going to be able to deal with the problems that come to us. Now, notice at the beginning of this chapter, it seems to me this is what Paul's getting at to them. He says, I don't want you to be unaware. Don't be forgetful. Read this Bible story and make some application of it to your own life. What was the generation of the Israelites, our fathers, with Moses in the wilderness like? Well, they were all under the cloud and passed through the sea. And of course, he's talking particularly about the parting of the Red Sea and being covered by the cloud of God. And so his point is, they're surrounded by all this moisture, and that is a kind of baptism. It is as if they are immersed into Moses, just like we've been immersed into Christ. And then secondly, he says, they all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. And that sounds very much like the Lord's Supper. And it may very well have been that the attitude of the Corinthians was, well, I've been baptized, and somehow just by virtue of going through the ritual of being immersed in water into Jesus Christ, that somehow makes you inoculated against sin and temptation. That somehow because you're a Christian, you have some kind of magic aura that wards off the contagion of sin. Or perhaps because we continue partaking the Lord's Supper, engaging in this spiritual experience weekly, that somehow makes us strong spiritually. And yet, what happened to these very same people? They heard the gospel that was preached by Moses. The Hebrew writer makes the very same argument. They heard the word, it was preached to them, just like it's been preached to you, but it was not united with faith in those who heard. It didn't do them any good. And so, who died in the wilderness? Well, God's people died in the wilderness. The very ones who heard God Himself speak the Ten Commandments to them. The very ones who themselves had seen the plagues of Egypt and the parting of the Red Sea. There was nothing about that experience that miraculously guaranteed that they would be pleasing to God and get through all of this. And so, verse 5, however, with most of them, God was not well pleased, and their bodies carpeted the wilderness. You know, they all were immersed, they all ate, they all drank, but most of them died in the wilderness. And so we can come here and say, oh, I've been baptized, and I take the Lord's Supper, and we can add a lot of other things to that. Well, what does that mean? If they could go through those same experiences and still succumb to temptation and fail and ultimately come under God's judgment and God's wrath, same thing can happen to us. And that's Paul's very point. And don't think then you're going to go out and participate in these sins that God has specifically forbidden you to do, and that everything's going to be fine with God. And so don't overestimate your own spiritual strength by virtue of all the good that you do and how spiritual you are and all of that. And the flip side of that, of course, is don't underestimate sin. The pernicious influence of sin. How often, you know, the Bible warns us about the deceitfulness of sin, as in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 13. But one of the very reasons we encourage one another daily is so that no one is hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 22, Paul talks about the lusts of deceit. That sin just has a way of constantly deceiving us as to what it's really up to, what its real consequences and influences are, and it sells itself as something much less dangerous than it is. And if we were just determined that sin is my absolute enemy, that sin is the one thing in this world that is out to destroy me, I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to get anywhere near it. You know, how much less we would succumb to the influence and the temptation of sin. And so we can't become complacent about sin, either because we think we're strong enough to handle it or because we don't take sin as seriously as we should. Well, a lot of it has to do with where we put our focus. You know, what are we looking at? Now, what the Corinthians were looking at was what they wanted to do. They wanted to fit in. They wanted to be good Corinthian citizens rather than being Christians. And they wanted to accommodate the gospel for the world and the culture in which they lived rather than trying to change the culture to be conformed and accommodate itself to the gospel. And that same temptation confronts us in one way or another today. And that's why we have Christians that think like the world thinks, Christians that dress the way the world dresses, Christians that choose as their entertainment the kind of things the world chooses as entertaining. But in Hebrews chapter 11, we have a catalog of great people of faith, and we could even find some of these people actually mentioned here that were involved in the situation in the wilderness. But as that chapter concludes, really at the beginning of chapter 12 then, the writer says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, apparently referring to all of these great worthies of the Old Testament who were people of faith and all that they accomplished by faith, and they're up in the stands watching us and cheering us on by their example again. You have that same idea of the examples that happened to them. These are positive examples instead of the negative examples we had from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let us also, that is like they did, lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the beginning and end of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart, that you will not become complacent spiritually. You have to keep your focus on Jesus. You have to keep considering, thinking about Jesus as your supreme example, to imitate him, to walk in his footsteps, to have the same attitude about sin that Jesus did, ultimately is what we're striving for. And that has to be the focus. And yet, when it comes to the things that people focus on, there can be a lot of different things. You know, people might have their focus religion. I don't know how many people I've had tell me, oh, I tried religion. Well, religion is not the answer. People don't need religion. They need God. Now, that's a form of religion that's related to what religion ought to be about. But it's not religion itself that is the issue. It is God. And for some of us, it may be good works. You know, we tend to look at those good things that we do. And we saw this example from the book of Zechariah in our auditorium class on Wednesday night, Zechariah chapter 7. Oh, I've been fasting for God. And God says, no, you haven't. You've not been doing the little things for me. Why would you think I'm thinking you're doing the big things for me? Now, you may have deceived yourself into thinking you're doing the big things for me, but I know better. Oh, good works. I go to church on Sunday, and I do this, that, and the other. Well, what does that mean? Apart from God. Apart from a heart that is truly devoted to God on the inside. Well, why do we gravitate to these things that people can see on the outside? Because a lot of times that's what we're interested in. Our focus isn't so much on what does God see when he looks at me, but what do other people see? What kind of credit can I get with them? What can I use other people for? And so really it boils down to anything but God. If anything but God is your focus is on the wrong thing. Focus has to always come back and be on Jesus. And you think about this, if our focus is on God, if we do fix our eyes on Jesus, there are two inescapable conclusions to that. And number one is you can never be good enough. If you ever take the attitude, well, that's good enough for God, what are you saying about God? Now, if your focus is on religion, you could say, oh, that's good enough. If your focus is on good works, you could say, I've done enough good works. But if your focus is on Jehovah God, the God of the Bible, and His majesty, His greatness, you could never say good enough. Never. And secondly, you can't hate sin enough. You can't despise it enough. It is an abomination to God. And our problem is we don't hate it nearly as much as God does. But if our focus is on God, it reminds us of just how horrible and terrible sin is, how completely contradictory to God sin is. It is something that so displeases Him. Even if I'm not to the point where it just so disgusts me personally, that there's still so much allurement and temptation to it, and appeal and lust. But God doesn't like it. And I don't want to have anything to do with what God doesn't like. And I can never be good enough. And I can never hate sin enough. And so those are the things I need to work on. But you know, what happens as a result of that attitude is the world says, well, because you can't ever be good enough and you can't hate sin enough, just kind of throw up your hand. It doesn't matter. Just do the best you can. And, you know, God doesn't care. Well, that's not what the Bible says. You know, we can't be complacent again. That's the whole point of why we were looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It's not complacency that we're looking for. It's not being resigned to the reality of what's going on in our life. It is the determination that we're not just going to rest upon what we have done in Christ. Oh, I've been baptized. I take the Lord's Supper. But I'm going to constantly keep my eyes focused on Jesus. What does God want me to do? And if I truly love Him and trust in Him, rather than looking at His grace and mercy to me as a license that just frees me to go out and live as I please and live a completely self-centered and self-indulgent life, I'll rather be motivated to want to be like Him and to have His character and to be patient as He is patient and holy as He is holy and all the other things that describes God. And so it is, we will end with a passage back from 1 Corinthians again, this time the very end of chapter 9, which runs us up into what he argues here in chapter 10. And you'll notice that Paul here uses a very similar argument to what the Hebrew writer did, a similar image of running the race with endurance. Now the reason Paul brings this up here is because his exhortation to the Corinthians is they are complacent. And they need to take this seriously. And they need to start running this race as if their lives depend on it. And so, yeah, I could accept the statement I made a moment ago, do the best you can, because that's all you can do. But sometimes we say, do the best you can, and we don't really mean it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, you run as fast as you can, and you think you're running as fast as you can, but you let some bear come chasing after you or some bad guy with an axe. I mean, you might be able to find you've got a little bit more in you to run faster than you thought you did. Run as if your life depends on it, because it does. And so 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Now, he's not saying there's only one prize in heaven, and out of all the millions of Christians there ever been or will be, only one will make it. You know, that's the ultimate lottery, isn't it? You might as well give up now. No, it's not his point, but his point is if you're going to run a race, and you know there's only one that can win, how fast are you going to try to run if you really want to win? You're going to put everything into it because, again, your life as a runner depends on it. And that's the way in which you need to run, as if there is only one that's going to make it to heaven, as if there is nothing else you can do but run. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. And they then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. You know, their great prize was wilted celery. That's what they'd actually give people as a prize for winning the games that were held there in Corinth. When you talk about a perishable wreath, I mean, it's already half perished when they give it to you. And yet, it's, of course, the great honor that went with it, not the physical crown itself. Paul said, we are given an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. You've got to really apply yourself. You've got to put some effort into this. You cannot be complacent about sin. Don't think you're stronger than you are. Don't minimize and underestimate the power and influence of sin. And here's some sad examples of people who did that very thing. And so let's take heed. If we think we stand, lest we fall. And let's recognize that with every temptation, God provides a way of escape for us. We've been singing songs that have to do with this great battle that we're engaged in. And that's another great imagery of this very point that we're saying. Our lives do depend upon the outcome of this battle. Now, the outcome of the war is assured. God's going to win. The only thing that hangs in the balance is on what side of that battle do I fall? Will I be on the losing side, or will I be on the victorious side with God? So if you will, take your songbook and turn to number 34. We're going to sing another song that causes us to reflect upon this. And if there's some changes we need to make in our life to be more serious about sin and to take care of some things in our life and to do better, and again, we can all do better. But if there's some particular way we can be of help to one another, let us know what we can do for you while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.